welcome to Worlds Apart. Historically, Central and Eastern Europe has been an arena of both fierce competition and pragmatic collaboration for Russia and the West. With the latest Donald Trump's proposal and subsequent refusal to hold another US-Russia summit on the European soil in Budapest, can the conflict in Ukraine still be dislodged out of its literal dead end? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Petr Drulek, a former deputy foreign minister of the Czech Republic. Mr. Drulek, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, as we are recording this interview, it's still unclear whether, when, and where the meeting between the two presidents can take place, because President Trump said that he canceled the summit in Budapest, but he still says that he's, you know, willing to work towards ending this war. Where are we in this rather disorienting and somewhat haphazard drive to put an end to this conflict?
Well, we are in a pretty confusing situation, which is quite usual, actually, with the Trump administration. And the way I read it, actually, is that there are basically three possible explanations for what happened in last week, because there was a call between the two leaders. And there is one possibility that they genuinely did not understand each other, that there was some genuine misunderstanding between Trump and Putin. That's one possibility. The other possibility is actually that Trump actually changed his mind, because he's quite erratic. So one day he says one thing, the other day he says another thing. So that's also possible. But there is also the third possibility that he's actually quite steady, but there are some people in his inner circle which come from the deep state, and the American deep state is not that much interested in peace in Ukraine. So even though Trump has certain line, they are actually able actually to break this line and to make him change his opinions. So for me, these are the three explanations which can tell us, or which can give us some guidance on what's happened in the last days.
I think it's pretty easy to change, if not Trump's opinion, but his sort of emotional state, because he seems to be very influenced by the emotionality of the people he engages with. But when it comes to the actual structural policy, it is something that requires a lot of work, and you cannot change it even during the 2.5-hour telephone conversation between the leaders, which leads me to my next question, because I think at this point of time, Moscow and Washington have very different, if not conflicting, definitions of what would it mean to put an end to this war. Because for Trump, it's all about stopping the bloodshed. He keeps talking about, you know, the Ukrainian, the Russian soldiers being killed on the battlefield. But as I'm sure you know, for the Kremlin, it is far more strategic. It's, you know, solving the deep security disagreements and threats that Russia sees in Ukraine because of its alliance, formal or informal, with the West. Do you think the latter is feasible, you know, sorting out the sort of preceding causes for this bloodshed?
Well, I think it is feasible, but it's definitely very, very difficult. It won't be easy because, you know, Russia actually invested a lot into this conflict. Ukraine is a territory which it considers vital for its survival, for its national interest. But for Americans, it's somehow different, because they also invested a lot, and they at this point they do not want to lose their face, because you know, if they accepted the Russian terms completely, they would actually feel humiliated, and their reputation in the world would be even lower than it is right now. So that's why there is this actually there are these very difficult negotiations, misunderstanding. I think Russian goals are quite clear. They are, on the one hand, territorial goals. On the other hand, there are goals concerning the future status of Ukraine. And for the United States, the major issue is not to be humiliated, to look like a strong power which does not sell its allies or its vassals. So that's why it is not as easy as it could seem.
I think there's now a conflict between a strong power that doesn't want to be humiliated, and a strong leader that perhaps wants to score some points, even at the humiliation of his strong power. Because Trump, even in canceling the Budapest summit, he actually said that he's okay with Russia, with the conflict being settled, as he put it, on the current line. So in terms of territorial gains, I think he's fine with that. The problem is, in my view at least, is a bigger security arrangement in Europe, the so-called security dilemma, how the European countries could coexist together and what role the United States will play in all of that.
Yes, you know, of course, I mean, the big question then is the future security architecture of Europe. But I think they did not come to that. They are still, you know, I mean, we are still at the issue of Ukraine. And, well, what I heard in the media, and in the media there is a lot of disinformation, so one doesn't know really what was going on. There seems to me there is a genuine misunderstanding about the territorial goals. Because for Russia, it's actually Crimea and the four regions. Whereas what I heard from the American side, they talked about just two regions, Donetsk Oblast, Luhansk Oblast, forgetting about the other two regions. So it seems to me that there is some sort of a genuine misunderstanding at play as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me take us back for a little while to a non-event, that is a summit in Budapest that wasn't supposed to be. And it was reported by CNN that Budapest had been considered as a possible venue even for the first Putin-Trump summit, and only later on Anchorage was selected. I wonder, in symbolic terms, what do you think it would mean for the leaders of Russia and the United States to meet in Budapest and hopefully try to, if not settle their differences, then at least to, you know, embark on the road?
Well, it would be a great event. Well, I think it would be great even per se, because it would be a summit which would bring us closer to the peace. So that's important. Any summit anywhere is important. And the fact that it would take the place in Central Europe is important, because Central Europe is one of the regions which are actually most exposed to the war, in Ukraine, in terms of energy prices, in terms of the refugees which are coming to our countries. So it would be quite actually natural place where the two leaders could meet. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is also the personality of the host of this summit, Prime Minister Orbán, who is one of the few European leaders who actually understands what's at stake, mm-hmm. and who has the ability to look at the conflict, at mm-hmm. international politics, mm-hmm. from a realist perspective. Mm-hmm. So these are actually important things which would be somehow confirmed if the summit took place in Central Europe.
Mm-hmm. I think Central Europe is not only the place most exposed to the negative consequences of the current rift between Russia and the West, but it's also, you know, a very rare place where the interests of the United States and Russia actually practically coexist. You mentioned Viktor Orban, but it's not just about his personality. It's the sort of the brand of European politics that he represents, standing for pragmatism, standing for national interests, standing for diplomacy, standing for cooperations with nations that you don't necessarily like, but you try to find common ground, not taking, you know, the best possible outcome for granted and understanding that you actually have to engage in order to achieve it. Do you think that kind of politics has a future in Europe? Do you think the urbanization of the European politics is possible?
Well, if we call urbanization a realist term, then I think it's actually the only future possible. But it will take some time, because European Union and its leaders turned very, very ideological. So they deny the reality. They deny the obvious things. So unfortunately, we will have to wait for some time before they clash with the reality. This mm-hmm. clash will be painful. It can be economic clash. I hope it will be economic clash rather than military clash. But this clash will wake them up. And before that, we will hear from the European leaders the same propaganda. So as I say, Viktor Orbán is somehow exceptional. He's not the only one. We have Robert Fico in Slovakia, who also is able to take quite pragmatic and, I would say, courageous steps. But there are not many more, actually.
Now, your book called Velvet Capitalism and the Crisis of Liberal Democracy is about to be released. And I think it explains in in detail how we or how the Europe got where it is. Now, what strikes me, though, is that over the past few years, Western policies have all but lost their velveteen, soft texture, and they became very abrasive, not only towards adversaries, but also towards, you know, their allies or their own populations. What do you think explains this very dramatic change of policy style from trying to be soft and liking soft power to being steely rigid?
Well, I think it's actually linked with the loss of the Western power. Because if we compare with the 1990s, in the 1990s, Western Europe, United States were at the peak of the global power. Their position was uncontested. Today, we are in a very completely different world. World is multipolar, and also there is actually a growing criticism inside Europe and inside United States concerning the political model of the society. So these the elite actually feels threatened. They feel that their positions are not as safe as they used to be. And it seems to me that this vulnerability, this uncertainty provokes them into much more aggressive behavior than we could have imagined in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, this vulnerability, it stems not necessarily from the outside. I mean, structural problems within the EU have been accumulating for many decades. And perhaps the reason why these leaders or the elites feel vulnerable is because they are not doing anything to actually correct those problems.
Well, you are right. It's part of the rigid structure of the European and I would say the Western governance, because they have their own dogmas, they have their own scenarios, and they are not able to change them. They are not able to adjust them to the new reality. These scenarios might have been actually quite useful in the 1980s and in the 1990s, but they are not useful now. And unfortunately, the elite is actually too rigid to replace them with new scenarios and with actually new playbooks.
Mm-hmm. You know, I study psychology on the side, and I think one of the biggest challenges in personal human development is actually the quality of transitions, for example, from childhood to adolescence to adulthood. And you cannot assume that if you had like beautiful childhood or easy adolescence, that the same will happen in adulthood. It's a very arduous process. You always have to adjust. You have to exercise a lot of patience, a lot of differentiation, a lot of care. And I assume on the collective level, it's far more difficult because we are all laden with our historical or collective traumas. I wonder if the problem here is not only the concept of liberal capitalism, which you said has certain limits, but this whole notion of social engineering and how fast or how easy it's supposed to be, just wishing progress into existence without understanding that you have to adjust your ways, even if you are successful.
You know, one of the problems was that actually the European leaders believed that all the problems have been solved in the 1990s. That's the idea of Fukuyama, the end of the history. I mean, in the 1990s, the history ended. And from now on, all the countries will adhere to the liberal democracy. Now they see that it is not the case and they do not know how to react. But, you know, this liberal capitalism, it's a very nice idea. But it's very actually distant from the practice because, I mean, it's somehow like communism. Communism was also a very nice idea of a free society where everyone lives in harmony with everyone. Most often we did not get that. We got quite brutal dictatorships. With liberal capitalism, you have actually a very nice idea of freedom, prosperity for everyone. But what you have in reality is quite brutal oligarchy, which is actually less and less liberal in the sense of respecting freedom, and which is only liberal in the sense actually of protecting the profits of the leading oligarchs. Mm. So in this sense, you know, this is a societal model they stick to, and they don't see actually that it is less and less respected and less and less demanded, actually, by their people.
Well, Mr. Drulic, let me stop you here because we need to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Hey, I see you're washing the Moscow mules. And we're gonna brainwash the crap out of you.
Getting word from Red Square.
Who are you? I don't care what my voters say.
I am not a warmonger. I am a peacemaker.
Eating the dogs, eating the cats.
Huggy, there you go. All squeaky clean.
Hi, my name is Tume Lubiko. I'm speaking to you from the CBD of Cape Town in South Africa. To me, neocolonialism is the inability to honor the boundaries between different people's cultures, economies, and borders. What's increasingly happening is that our children, people that are studying, older people, are holding phones and digital devices that are the gateway for an intrusion into their lives. This happens at the level of media and telecommunications. This happens at the level of educational resources. This happens at the level of economies and how decisions can be made by officials about what's in the best interest of each country. It seems like the West is hell-bent on shaping the world completely in their own image. Our work is to emphasize the need to be independent, to follow what Black consciousness taught us, which is that the individual presents to themselves and the rest of the world their most authentic form. And the only way to do so is to be who you are and to be proud of who you are in the context of the community that you've grown up in, and to push back against the insidious work that's been done to invalidate people's cultures. We'll speak about this and other topics on RT. My name is Tume Lubiko. Thank you.
For 20 years, we've broken all the rules you invented.
You're watching RT.
Antum tushahiduna kanat RT.
Están viendo RT.
Vous regardez RT.
Here's the today.
You claimed we were brainwashing your citizens. You accused us of running troll factories. You screamed that we buy off bloggers and celebrities. Made Trump great, and then made him great again.
Russia today is capable of conducting information war.
We know that RT possessed cyber capabilities.
To ban Russia today because of the nature of propaganda.
To get in their bullhorn.
Are we a propaganda bullhorn? Well, it's time to say sorry. Sorry not everyone has heard us yet. We're always working on making our bullhorn louder.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Petr Drulak, a former deputy foreign minister of the Czech Republic. Mr. Drulak, I heard you say in another interview that this increasing rivalry among the major world powers enforces a black and white vision, and we partially touched on that in the first part already. But I have a tiny argument with that, because what we see right now between Russia and the West is that Putin and Trump, Russia and the United States, can at least fathom a prospect of diplomacy, or they can engage in some cooperation. Sure, it's not very productive, but at least there's some engagement between the parties. But what we have in Europe, for example...
That must be changed. And it's actually quite unusual in European history, because it used to be Europe which was calling for diplomacy. And they were actually warning United States against being actually too cowboy-like, to be like easy to reach to guns. Europeans always said, no, let's talk to people. Let us not send the soldiers, the troops. That used to be the usual European position. Now it changed. And I think it's somehow linked again with this ideology, because European leaders believe that they discovered the ultimate truth of the world. And the ultimate truth of the world in their vision is that the European Union or European nation discovered the very best model of society. And everyone who is not converging to this model of society is actually eventually an enemy. Mm-hmm. And they do not need any need to talk to enemies. They say, we will talk to you as soon as you will be like us. And that's actually not only false, that's not only incorrect, it's also quite stupid, because European Union and European nations are losing their positions. Mm-hmm. So if they do not want actually to land quite hard, they need to actually rediscover diplomacy and to talk with others and to find an agreement in a mutual respect. Right now, they are not ready to it. They do the same mistake to Russia. As they do to China. Mm-hmm. So that's ultimately they will be forced actually to acknowledge it. But mm-hmm. as I say, they are not ready for this acknowledgement right now.
Mm-hmm. Now I've heard some Russian analysts suggest that. Before this Trump's cancellation of the Budapest summit, Russian analysts suggested that for Putin to fly to Budapest could have been dangerous, not only because of the closure of the European airspace, let's say, by Poland, but simply because in the minds of the certain European politicians, Putin is not only the main culprit of the current situation, he is the main problem in and of itself, and that if he is somehow eliminated, you know, the whole thing will fall into pieces, and peace and prosperity and the idealistic world will be reinstated. Do you think that's an exaggeration, and do you think that perhaps there is some of that thinking that if we get rid of Putin, you know, all our problems will, you know, go away?
Well, there are some parts of the European elite who believe that it's somehow linked with the personality of the Russian President Putin. I'm not sure whether this is a mainstream idea, actually. But of course, it's an idea which is not correct. I don't believe that there are people actually in Europe who would seriously consider to prepare something like the elimination of the Russian president. That would be very dangerous, extremely dangerous. And it would be also counterproductive, because, you know, it's actually quite uncertain who would succeed President Putin if something happened to him. Mm-hmm. And it's delusional to believe that there would be his successor would be a liberal who would embrace Europe and who would give up on Ukraine and who would give up on everything. So in this respect, these are delusions, but some of these delusions are part of the European elite. But as I said, I don't believe there are people who would seriously consider an attack against the person of President Putin.
Well, and President Putin has a very good security detail, perhaps owning to his own FSB background, but there have been a number of very high-profile political assassinations in Ukraine, some of them in Europe, in the United States as well. And I've heard recently Professor John Mearsheimer say that the current situation in Europe structurally resembles the situation on the eve of World War I, which was then seen as an easy way out of many accumulated crises, and as we all know, was also sort of ignited with a political assassination. I wonder if you see any similarities there between the current situation and pre-World War I.
There is one similarity which I find actually quite dangerous, because in 1914, European nations were actually looking forward to go into the war. they expected the war. Each of them was expecting that the war will be short and victorious. And when I listen how the current European elites speak about the possibility of war with Russia, it seems to me as if they were almost looking forward to it. So that's a dangerous analogy. On the other hand, in 1914, the European nations were actually the real global great powers. They had formidable armies. That's not the case with the European Union today. I mean, their military capabilities are actually quite ridiculous. Mm-hmm. They are not actually able to wage a major war with a great power like Russia. So in this sense, it's even stranger, because in 1914, they believed they can win war and they had some capabilities. Today, they believe that they will wage war with Russia and they have no capabilities.
But Mr. Druluk, I think that the notion of military capabilities has also changed because some time ago, we've seen a Ukrainian attack on the part of Russia's Triad, and it's been speculated or alleged, at least by the Russian sources, that some Western countries were involved in planning of that attack as well. You yourself wrote that, you know, this war can be sparked either by misunderstanding or perhaps by provocation, and we've seen lots of such provocations recently. Now, what do you think would be an appropriate and measured response as far as Russia is concerned? Because on the one hand, you do want to deter these kind of provocations, but on the other hand, you also have to be very mindful and careful of not, you know, igniting a bigger conflict.
Well, it seems to me that the Russians' reactions so far were actually quite rational, in the sense that Russia actually explicitly warned against too much of the Western involvement in Ukrainian attacks. And it's obvious that some of these attacks actually, which happened, were actually at least coordinated and supported actually by the Western infrastructure. So there are some red lines which Russia has. Russia tries to communicate these red lines, and it seems to me quite reasonable to do this. Mm-hmm. Of course, if the Western involvement in these attacks becomes more intensive than it has been so far, we are in a very dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think Russia has not only warned that more provocations could be dangerous, it also adopted its own nuclear doctrine, stating that a conflict by a non-nuclear state in coordination with a nuclear state would be considered as an attack by the latter. Now, warning and drawing red lines is good, but they only work if the other side takes them seriously. And as we've been discussing throughout this conversation, it doesn't seem like the West is taking them seriously. So do you think sooner or later, I mean, I'm asking for your sort of gut intuition, do you think sooner or later you will see a Russian strike on targets beyond Ukraine?
Well, I hope we will not come to it. It seems to me that President Trump is aware of these dangers. And of course, once we speak about the Russian attacks beyond the territory of Ukraine, we talk about the war between the NATO and Russia. Nobody is interested in that. Russia is not interested in that. And I think NATO countries are not interested either. Definitely United States doesn't want to do that. So I believe in this sense, I would rely on some common sense, which we can find with parts of the Trump's administration, even though, as we said, Trump's behavior is rather erratic. Still, I believe that he's someone who is genuinely interested. He's genuinely interested in peace. So let's hope that we will not come to it, because if we come to it, then we really speak about a major tragedy for the whole of Europe.
Well, if that ever comes to pass, and I also wouldn't like to see that happen, I'm sure Russia would not strike a very serious target. I mean, to drive a message home, you don't need to cause a lot of damage. You can just move your retaliatory sort of response a little bit further. But again, that would be a very dangerous escalation. My last question to you right now is this. You said that, Mr. Trump, President Trump, is still not cutting the contacts with the Russians. He still tries to engage in some diplomacy, even though How effective it is another question. But what leverage do you think he has with the Europeans, or what leverage do you think the Europeans have with him? Because it's one thing to discuss something with President Putin. I think you can count on Russia to follow the steps that are agreed upon. But what about Europe? Can the Americans count on the Europeans to comply with their joint decisions?
Well, you are right that Europeans are acting as spoilers, as those actually who are doing their best to break these initiatives. On the other hand, we should not overestimate their influence. It seems to me that the important decisions are really taken in Washington without too much of consultation with European allies. This has already been the case always, not just under Trump. It has been the case under Clinton, Bush, Obama. It's always actually the Washington which makes the decisions, and then the Europeans follow. Where I see the problem is not so much the European allies, but actually parts of the American deep state, parts of the people who are in the intelligence services, who are part of the military industrial complex, and they may actually be much more influential than any European influence when we talk actually about disrupting President Trump's peace efforts.
Or maybe even more influential than President Trump himself, because for him, as we mentioned before, consistency is perhaps his own personal challenge. Anyway, Professor Drulic, it's been a great conversation. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.